Greetings and salutations, everyone. Okay, that's Altus. Anyway, welcome everyone. I am AC Jess. My name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and I am the net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. And this is our Labor Day edition. And thanks very much to Lou NY2H. Unfortunately, the router had a problem in the routine, and he went down there and chatted up the telephone company and such, and had them reset their settings, which were erroneous, and we now have back our IRLP and our Echo Link. So I thank Lou very much for his hard work in keeping these operational. Anyway, let me drop for a second, and I'll get back to the usual link that I tell everyone about. Okay. If you can't reach me via the radio, then an email is probably a good idea. That is, if you have any questions, that would be considered a mailbag question if you don't do it on the radio. Also, if you have any topics of interest that you want to hear discussed, or if you have any puzzles. I collect puzzles of a technical nature, and I like to ask them during these technical nets as an opportunity to expand, or remind people of some basic law of physics or such. So if you have such things available, please email me. And if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder, WS2N, and have him take a look at some NASA-related webpage or YouTube, I'll be more than happy to send them the link. You can do it directly to him, or you can do it through me. So the email address is mailbag@acdes.com. Again, mailbag at my call sign, which is Alpha Charlie 2 Gulf Sierra.com. I have a bunch of links. I have some links to interesting things that don't lend themselves to discussion on a radio because they're somewhat visual, or they're space-related and have more to do with what the poll does with the SpaceNet report. And in addition, I have some imagery from Paul that he sent me for his SpaceNet report tonight. And I also have a series of interesting science articles. If we have a time to do the science talk portion, they're available for review. So if I don't get to them, you can read them yourself. So the link page, again, is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room. You can either get to it going to Limark's own webpage and find the link there and clicking it, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that will bring you to the chat room. I stream the audio of this 24/7 or as much as I can. W2VL repeater audio, and you can hear it on the internet by typing into your browser technet.ac2g.com. And as always, I like to remind people that MikeKC2NJI has a great archive of technical nets going as far back as September 2006 at his website, amateurradio.tv. Check that out. I'll drop for a second and tell you my plans for tonight. Okay. It's going to be a regular one tonight. I hope that the Labor Day doesn't impact upon participation. I hope you're out there and curious and have questions and comments and what have you. But we will take questions or comments. I will ask people to give me their first name, their call sign. I'll write it down and try and get to them in an orderly fashion. If we have extra time, I'll open the subject to general science and even medicine, although we do not diagnose nor treat over the radio. Hopefully, we'll get to about 10:15 that way. I will call upon Paul, WS2N, to give us his SpaceNet report, which will take us to 11 o'clock. I'll return, put a bow on it, wish you all a safe and happy week, and call it a night. So that's my plan, if the repeater, my radio, and my amplifier all allow me to do that. So I'm hoping for the best. So let me drop and ask if anyone has any questions or topics tonight. Please give me your first name and your call sign.
Y2A, Tony.
Tony with his new call sign. Good job, Tony. Recognized? Okay, anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, well, we'll try one more time. If anyone has any questions or topics for tonight, please give me their first name and call sign. Okay, unfortunately, I partially doubled on that, and it was a lot of noise in there, so I couldn't make out the portion at the end. So if you could wiggle the antenna or raise the power output, whatever you can handle, let's try it again. If you want to give your call sign and your first name.
WP2AA Skype.
Chat recognized. Okay, anyone else want to put their name down for tonight?
KD2UAH, just supporting.
Okay, thank you very much, UAH. We'll start the questions, and hopefully as time goes on, there'll be a few more people who have some questions or comments or topics or what have you. So first on my list is Tony, NY2H. What can I do you for tonight, Tony?
Boy, everybody else on the net. I have a question today about perhaps I built one. That, actually, before I go on, maybe there's a little link at the top of the document that has various graphs that probably would be helpful in the questions while they're probably left.
Yes, I have them on the screen right now.
Okay, so my question is, bearing to maintenance by captain, depending on the source, some edges of the track is opposite, and they have references to the bow, which unfortunately none of the sources have any sort of explanation ever as to why. Actually, one source, I don't know why, but it's done it. Now, looking at the two sweeps, the only advantage I see that by putting the frequency of resonance above the band edge, my particular purpose is higher in T effective track. So I was wondering if you have other ideas, knowledge about preferable places.
Okay, that's an interesting one, Tony. The answer that you came up with sounds to me to be the best. I think it's more of just a practical experience. People tried both options, probably tried a bunch of other, and just they felt that the response of the trapped antennas gave them a better response. But I'd be interested if anyone out there has a more detailed explanation of the choice of the resonant frequency for traps on antennas. If anyone's out there with any good ideas, please hit that push to talk.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
The ARRL books had it for, not necessarily for traps, but, you know, antennas in general, you know, everything from a dipole all the way up, they always favored the lower side. The reason for it, let's say you had an antenna tuner, you know, and you're going to, let's say 80 meters, you know, 3.500, you know, be the lowest. And you know, you might be tuning up, you know, maybe 5 hertz up from that. You know, this way you're sure that, you know, when you sort of automatic antenna tuning, it's going to work. It's going to be, you know, for sure that you're going to be able to do it even if it's a manual antenna tuner. So you're always sure that you're always going to get the lower part of the frequency that you're looking for. But that's going way back. Things might have changed, you know, back here.
Okay, that's an interesting idea. I'm not sure if it really coincides with whatever technical aspects of traps are involved, just general practices. But anyone else with any good ideas on this particularly interesting question?
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
Well, basically, doesn't a trap is basically a parallel resonant circuit. So what it does, it's trapping thing. It's basically parallel resonant. So that's what actually cuts the antenna length at that frequency. Now, what happens above or below resonance, I guess, would affect the behavior of the antenna when it's not, when that trap is not functioning as a trap. So, I think a parallel resonance circuit when it's above resonance looks like, I think it looks capacitive. I could be wrong, or inductive, and that's going to add to resonance of the rest of the antenna. But when it does its trapping thing, it's basically parallel resonance, and that's what's cutting the antenna at that point. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's acting at resonance as a high impedance block of the longer element of the radiating antenna. That's the effective use of the trap, and you want to have a relative high complex impedance around the point where you want to use one band versus the other band of the trap antenna element. But I don't know whether it makes that much of a difference, whether the leading edge is inductive reactance or capacitive reactance. It might, but I don't see why it really would. I'm not quite sure if that's the ultimate solution to this question.
I think it might depend on what other bands you're planning to use and are on, because if it's going to be functioning at other bands, it might be optimistic. It might be optimal to put it, as you say, the edge on the high side versus the low side. It could depend on what else you're going to use that particular antenna on.
Okay, I assumed from the way that Tony phrased the question that the answer is generic and not dependent upon what bands the traps are designed for. Is that the case, Tony?
Well, yes. My initial question was generic. DDH's comment in terms of being passive is another point to mind.
Yes.
Inductive is the next portion of the L quarter because you got that sort of inducting effect. Conversely, if you make it capacitive, the reactance is passive. If the reactance is rather capacitive, it's going to force element longer. Now, I don't know how much. Probably a negligible amount that would impact. Right.
Okay, so, I mean, but ultimately all that would give you is less space that you have to build the antenna to. I mean, just by adjusting the length of the terminal element, you offset whatever inductance or capacitance that the trap might introduce. So I don't know if that's theoretically, I guess, a shorter antenna that works is better than a longer antenna that works, but I don't know if that's such a major factor. I tend to think that we all might be missing something. Again, unless it's just kind of practical experience that people tried it. You know, in the old days, that's how people came up with that magic 468 divided by the frequency in megahertz. It was trial and error, and they just came up with the equation, and it worked for many, many years. Many hams didn't really understand the end effect of being part of that equation. So I'm not quite sure if that adds that much. If your antenna terminal element was, say, 5 inches shorter, would that make your day?
WY2U.
Yes, Y2U.
Yeah, hi, the name is Mike. Believe it or not, well, my comments are going to be relevant to a dipole antenna or an antenna structure whose resonant frequency occurs very close to the middle of the band. Now, under those conditions, believe it or not, it is more appropriate to design a trap for a multi-band antenna that exhibits those characteristics. It will be more appropriate to put the trap on the high end of the band, and I'll tell you why. Let me drop a minute. Okay, so once again, assuming the antenna is exactly designed for the center of the band, on the low end of the band, it'll be capacitive. On the higher end of the band, it'll be inductive. The trap exhibits exactly the opposite behavior. On the lower frequencies, it's capacitive if it's a parallel resonant circuit. And on the higher on the lower frequencies, it's inductive. I'm sorry, I said it backwards. And at higher frequencies, the parallel resonant circuit is capacitive. So you got inductance working with capacitance pretty much across the whole band with an exact radiation resistance, zero capacitive reactance and zero inductive reactance in the middle. What that'll do is tend to make the trap impedance at that antenna more constantly higher than it would be if you put the trap in the center or if you put the trap on the lower end of the band. So, again, my comments are based on an antenna that is optimally designed so that its best resonance occurs near the center of the band. I hope that clears it up. WY2U.
6U. Which antenna are you talking about? I just switched on the radio.
Wesley, we're discussing Tony NY2H was asking, he's building traps for his antenna, and he was wondering why the preference of the resonant point for the trap. So you could add whatever you want, but Mike, I think that's an excellent reason that makes perfect sense to me. Tony, I think we have an answer.
Yeah, I think I'm following it. I might want to ask Mike a couple follow-up questions. Now, the way I'm interpreting what you're saying by having it resonant immediately in the center, I know that's just for purposes of argument or an academic purpose, but you're not saying to put the resonant frequency itself in the middle of the band, because that would, my understanding would be a bad thing, because you're actually lowest at the resonant frequency, and you wouldn't have that point of resonance within the band, and pretty much universally across the board is that you're trying to get the resonant frequency lower immediately above it. Maybe I misunderstood your explanation, but if you can clarify that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, okay, Tony, but I'm not looking at the trap as an entity by itself. I'm looking at the trap as an integral part of the antenna. And the only assumption I'm making about it is that the antenna itself, this gets a little nasty, too, because the antenna itself, in conjunction with the trap, wants to be designed for the center of some band. Now, if you get what I mean, because at some points, at frequencies where the trap is not resonant, it's either going to be a capacitive or an inductive reactance, and if you're going to put that on an antenna, its reactance itself is going to affect the resonant frequency of the antenna. It's kind of a triple interactive type of a process, which might be a little bit difficult to sort out if you try to go through it. It would be a good thing to do iteratively on a computer, but trying to come up with the math could be a little nasty. But anyway, assuming it's the... Wait, drop a second.
Like being caught between a rock and a hard place.
So assuming the antenna system with the trap in place exhibits a resonance close to its intended band, it would be better to put that trap's resonance at the higher end of the bands that you're trying to trap. Let me say it that way. At the bands that you're trying to trap. It's easy to say, it may not be so easy to do, if you get what I'm saying there, Tony.
Yeah, Roger, I do. Now I'm understanding exactly what you're saying, and actually, for my purposes, for practical purposes, that makes sense as well, because this particular antenna that I use portable, so my part's not trying to say the general thing, portion of the band, to get my maximum peak towards the top third end, which, per my sweeps of the trap that I made before I wanted to do.
Sounds like you got a handle on what you want to do. Okay, Tony, very good. Well, that's my 2 cents anyway. It just seems to me that if you want a more constant high impedance presented to the bands that you don't want to, that the inactive bands on the antenna would be, it seems to me if you could design the trap so it's favoring the high end of those bands. And that'll give you more constant performance across the entire band. As far as the trap antenna system is concerned, not necessarily as far as the trap is concerned, but you got to embed the trap itself on the antenna. Hope that made some sense. Let's go back to Net, WY2U.
AC2GS. Well, thank you, Mike. It's more than 2 cents worth. Again, that makes perfect sense to me. The other answer sounded useful, but this fundamentally kind of makes physics sense to me. So I thank you very much for your participation tonight.
Okay, sir, my pleasure. I'm going to go upstairs and actually watch some TV, but I'll have a handy talk in nearby just in case. You guys have the rest of the enjoy the rest of the day. Enjoy the holiday tomorrow. WY to you.
Hey, Mike, before you go, a quick follow-up.
Okay, yes.
And or Roy or anybody else. The other thing that I've been thinking of is there a particular bottom limit in terms of impedance that makes a trap effective? Like, I mean, what I've designed here, what I've built here, actually, you're talking about across the band anywhere from 1.3 kilohms to 1.6 kilohms. That, I would imagine, is perfectly sufficient, but is there a low end, like, that you go low, just in a theoretical point of view?
Well, your rule of thumb is not exactly correct. The actual trap impedance to be a trap would want to be approximately 5 to 10 times greater than the terminal impedance of the antenna. Well, if it's 72 ohms, anything greater than about 600 to 720 ohms would be fine. But if you're trying to trap an antenna that looks like 400 ohms, well, then you're going to need something like 2,000 or 4,000 ohms. So it depends on what the antenna structure looks like.
Okay, excellent. So five times the feed point impedance, correct? Minimum?
Yeah, if you go through it, that'll give you better than a 2-to-1 mismatch. So, yeah, anything better than 5-to-1 on the trap impedance will guarantee at least a 2-to-1 VSWR on the active antenna.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate it. Thank you, Roy. I don't have anything to add unless somebody else wants to add to it, but I appreciate everybody's help and like you.
Okay, once again, thank you, Mike, and thank you, Tony, for participating tonight. Many of us learned something new. A lot of times we do things because we just read how we're supposed to do them. Whatever material sometimes doesn't have a cogent explanation of why, so it's always good to know why. Wesley, I think you just wanted to know what we were talking about, but do you have anything to add right now?
Actually, I'm following what I have a problem with is the event from the application. There was W3G antenna. That was the old concept using traps. They could have a 2 or 3 band trap system that has the additional piece of wire that is extending length of the antenna of a lower band using the traps to actually to isolate, so this resonance system is actually to isolate that part of the extended wire. You don't use it for this particular band. But the problem is that I just realized how maybe I just woke up and I'm totally confused. It's a shame, yeah. Parallel resonance system is actually not allowing one single frequency to get through, but it's allowing all of the other frequencies to get through. Since reverse, the series resonance system is actually allowing only one frequency to go through. And now it's like, yes, I understand how it works, everything is fine, but what's happened if I have a piece of wire and then I have a trap in it and then I have another piece of wire and the trap is part of the resonance system? So now how that extends if that particular frequency is not allowed? It's not really that I don't understand how it's not allowed. It's like how that actually makes that piece of wire to be connected to the other frequency that it's supposed to be extended to. If parallel resonance systems allows all of the frequencies, so any frequency would go with less or more gain, and to extreme.
Okay, I'm not quite sure what the question is, but the concept is it's a parallel resonance circuit. At resonance, at perfect resonance, it impedes any of the RF from going to an extra length of wire, so it lessens the mechanical distance which you need for the shorter frequency. So when you use the shorter frequency of the band, it doesn't conduct through the trap, and it resonates through the shortened segment. When you shift to the lower frequency, it goes through the trap and circulates through the entirety of the antenna system, which is now mechanically much longer and has a resonance at that lower frequency. So I'm not quite sure what you're trying to get at.
Okay, a trap is a parallel twin circuit capacitor in parallel with the conductor. The parallel twin circuits are used in all sorts of radio applications. They are selective in concert of the resonance frequency at which it has a high impedance. At the frequencies below the resonance frequency, the reactance of parallel tuned circuit will be inductive. Above the resonance frequency, the reactance will be capacitive. So we could have a modeling of the traps. I think I know the answer. The traps are modeled in antenna. They assume a perfect capacitor and inductor with a small series of resistance, which take into the account the resistance of the conductor and the core losses. If we use the antenna system, the trap can be used to isolate one part of an antenna from the other. And I think that was my confusion that created a problem. Well, let me drop it. So let's say we have a dipole antenna left arm and the right arm and the coaxial cable. At the end of those two, you have a trap, and then you have extending piece of the wire. If that trap is a parallel resonance circuit that is tuned to that particular frequency that is not allowing for that antenna to be physically longer. So let's say we have a 14 meters band, and then we have a trap and it's extending to, not 14 megahertz. Band, and then we have a trap, and after the trap we have the extended piece of wire for 7 megahertz. That trap must be tuned for 14 megahertz. That means once we operate at 14 megahertz, physically that trap actually makes that dipole shorter. The other part of the wire is not seen. Is that how I supposed to be understanding that and to explain?
Yes, Wesley, that's the concept of a trap. The nuance that Tony brought to the table was, should it be, at what point on 14 megahertz? Because it's the 14, it's the 20 meter band. So where in the 20 meter band do you want to set the resonant point for the tuned trap? That was what his question and the answer was. But fundamentally, that's how, as you just described it, that's how a trap operates.
Yeah, so we would have as long an antenna as we need it to have, and each trap, hold on, sorry, okay, I'm here. So each trap will actually make that antenna physically longer for the other frequencies, and to extra.
Yeah. The gist of it is that, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. It was my confusion. I just woke up. I saw that I'm late on a technet, and head didn't work. And to extra.
Okay, no problem, Wesley. Next on my list is Chet, WA2AHK. What's your question tonight, Chet?
Okay, everybody. This is just basically an update from last week when I was wondering if anybody knew how to tune a Anytone Model 868. Andy talking. and all I needed was two frequencies below 430, and the radio came in set up by the factory for 430 to 450. And at any rate, I was successful after many hours to getting two frequencies below 430 for my needs. And that's all I was interested in was the two for the radio was just two frequencies below 430. Took a little while, and I finally got it to dogged determination. But it's not easy. It's not easy. I also went on the internet and I tried to reach out to other people who might be able to help me to get the radio to work from the front panel without having the programming, computer programming, you know, to put frequencies in the band range that it was designed for, but they never came back, they got back to me. But anyway, I'm very happy anyway after all that work, many, many hours, I finally got my frequencies in. So if anybody has one of those situations, you can contact me. And I'll tell you how I finally did it. It wasn't easy. The other thing was, the other thing is, the 868 on the internet, the factory information is that the 868 and the 878 are the same radio, with the addition of a little more different software for a couple of different applications. And I think there was one circuitry they added, very minor circuitry that they added. So basically it's one radio, almost the same. I would imagine that the 878 software would operate the 868. I'm also, not vice versa, the 868 software wouldn't operate the 878 and it's, for its, all the circuitry and software that it requires, because the 868 software is less advanced than the 878 software, but vice versa, the 878 would obviously, as far as I could see, operate the 868. Okay, so that's all. I was lucky. I got what I needed, and I've been using it. I love the audio. It's great audio. So that's all I wanted to mention to the group. WB2AHK. Over.
Okay, Chad. Well, all's well that ends well. I do have some questions. I assume it is complicated to the point where you don't think that you could even give us an outline overview of how you perform this magic, but let me just ask one question. If any of it involves switching the band plan settings on the radio. Also, just want to mention that my understanding of there's a few different models of the 868 and 878 these days. I've lost track. I think there's a 2 or a 3, Roman numeral or something. I think the 78 does have a Bluetooth module in it that the 68 doesn't. There's also ATR capability on the 878. I'm not sure whether or not the 868 has an ATR module in it. So I think there's a couple little hardware changes or additions. It's pretty much the same stock model with a little bit extra. That was my understanding. But Chet, just as a matter of a hint, was the band plan needed to be changed, or was it something completely different?
Bravo Zulu?
Yes, Rich recognized, but let Chet answer first, and then we'll go back to you, Rich.
For programming use, just for what I wanted to do, I had to change the band plan, but it only works temporarily. It actually didn't change the band plan. It just allowed me to put two frequencies in, and that was it. And that's exactly what someone said last week. You turn the radio off, you push the talk and the number one button simultaneously, you turn the power switch on, let it start to boot, let go of the push the talk and the number one, and then with the frequency knob, you turn the band plan to 0000. That allowed me to put two frequencies in. But it didn't stay like that. It went back, eventually, after I turned the radio off, went back to the original band plan that it came with. So, and I had to use the code plug. The radio comes from the factory with some frequencies in it. And the proper code plug had a code plug and it had some frequencies in for that particular band plan. And what I did was I deleted the information in the two of those frequencies after I did what I said with the push and talk in the number one and put in my frequencies in. And they held. And in other words, I deleted two frequencies in the original code plug and put my two frequencies in. And the frequencies I needed stayed in there. And when I turned the radio off, they still were there, those frequencies, but I couldn't put any new additional information in from that point. I still would have to delete two other frequencies, or one other frequency, or depending on how many frequencies I want, and then I still have to go and hold the push-to-talk and the number one down, and boot up the radio, and then change the band plan back to 0000, which is just a temporary situation. Because the radio will revert to the band plan that it was set up for. Over.
Okay, that's interesting. So apparently, seeing one of the previously set up slots, you used a off-frequency replacement, and you were able to upload it to the radio, and it took it. That's great. Confusing as heck, but whatever works.
That's it. Okay, BC, I think, is next, right?
Yes, indeed. Well, Chet, I'm glad that you found the solution to the problem. I hope people were listening, and if they didn't quite get it, you know, your name's in the book, so they can check, look you up. Rich, you wanted to make a comment?
It's Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. I never had a problem with my 868 and band plans. The other thing that it does have, that it doesn't have that the 878 does have, which I found no need for, is roaming. In other words, if you're driving down the New Jersey Turnpike, it'll go to the next repeater that it finds. And since most people today are using other than repeaters are using hotspots, I didn't find that necessary. I tried as hard as I could to convince myself to get the 878 over the 868, and I just couldn't do it. And it wasn't a matter of money. It was a matter of functionality that was just too close for me. Go ahead.
Okay, I understand. I really like the idea of the Bluetooth feature. Haven't really used it that much, but played with it the first day. You know, whatever. I think, though, the roaming could very easily be software-based, that the firmware for the 878 codes the roaming, whereas the 868 might be capable of it with a firmware update or tweak, whereas I don't think you could get the Bluetooth functionality. I think if someone opened up the 868, that they would find that there was no Bluetooth module. So there's no bit of firmware that could cause an invisible module to work. So I don't know. I don't know the details of the difference between the hardware design of the 868 and 878.
Telling thing is that they haven't really they hit it out of the park the first time is the way I look at it. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've repeatedly almost advertised that I don't own any stock in whatever company Anytone is, but the 878 is a very good radio. I have used it well for a year or two. I have no complaints whatsoever. There is a new version, again, not sure if it's a 2 or a 3 Roman numeral. As far as I could see, the only significant improvement shifted from, I think, an analog APRS to an analog and digital APRS, or the other way around, and they also increased the memory chip, so your contact list In the old models, it would take 250,000 DMR IDs, and now can take 500,000 contact IDs, which, okay, it's an improvement, but it's not something that you basically want to throw away your old 878 for and buy a shiny new 878 Mark II or Mark III, whichever it is. But yeah, it's a very well-designed radio, and you know, the user interface, the field programmability, probably not quite as good as I would like it to be, but it's serviceable, and using the software works fine. It's the same CPS software that every Chinese radio seems to run. It looks like it was written in Visual Basic around 1998, the original source code, and just updated as the years went on. It is slow as molasses. I don't care how many multi-threads your computer has. It runs like a racehorse that's been put to sleep. Put to sleep.
Yes, I guess they figure once they give you the functionality, their job is done. And they don't have to make it easy on you or whatever. They give you the radio, it works, and they go swimming or something.
I think, you know, Chinese companies are not really software driven. If you look around, you find that their software tends to be universally kludgy, unless it's done by some place outside of China. Their engineering ability is far better than their general understanding of the English language. That's what kind of gives us those Chinglish manuals, which we all know and love. So they're just not into software yet. It might change over time, but right now, you know, if you want inexpensive electronics, they seem to be the masters of it. Innovation, not really, but, you know, once you get an idea into their minds and they just crank it out so that the price drops precipitously. So, you know, you got the good, you got the bad. I'm not expecting the CPS software to be rewritten by anyone too soon. It's not a high thing on their goal list, so it's not going to happen. But, you know, it's one of the negatives. There's lots of positives. There's a few negatives, like anything in this universe. Unless you spend way too much money, there's always something not so good about a product.
This is W2BZ. Did I get it right that it wasn't the 868 wasn't holding the band plan?
Yes, that is what Chet reported. Now, you have to keep in mind that probably his 868 is not exactly identical to your 868. He bought it recently, and Anytone incorporated some aspects, making it difficult for the radio to be fully opened up as per the FCC. So probably in the firmware, they put a kind of restriction that when you change the band plan to completely open, which the 0000 is, that it doesn't allow it on a reset. Again, if you're very clever, got a lot of free time, and can disassemble the firmware, you probably can fix that thing too. But I think that's what's going on. I don't think it's, once again, a hardware change. I think it was just a firmware change.
Yes, they had lunch with the FCC. W2BC back to them.
WB2HK.
Yes, Jeff.
Okay, the only thing I don't like about it, because I operate it on HF, I actually use it to talk on HF through my remote base. And when I'm talking to somebody on Vox, you know, Vox conversation, some people don't wait a second or two before they start talking to the other person on the other end. And the any tone takes its time to change from receive to, from transmit to back to receive. It's almost like a second or a second and a half, believe it or not, before it goes back to receive. It's kind of slow that way. So that's the only thing that I'm not too happy with, but it's no big thing. I can live with that. But it is kind of slow, and it's transmit to receive and receive to transmit. Well, not the, it's from the transmit to receive changeover. It's a little bit slow. Go ahead.
Okay, that's odd. I wonder why it's doing that. Just as an aside, did you experience any problems with desensing? Because the front end of that little radio must be wide open for everything. So I'm assuming it's not really good. It's not getting desensed rather easily.
No, it's very good. I'm running, let's say, 400 watts PEP at the time, right nearby, and HF. And the ND tone is not seemingly at all affected by it at all. And it's pretty good, adjacent channel and all that, but it's up there. It's very good in every which way. I really like it. It's a great radio. It's pretty. And it has 1 watt output audio, which is great, and has many good attributes. I didn't pay too much money for it because they're trying to, I think, sell them all out. And I paid on eBay $159.99, but then you had to pay shipping and tax. But the price was right, so I bought it.
Okay, very good. Glad to hear. Enjoy it. Have fun with it. Like I said, I have an Anytone. Rich has an Anytone. I'm sure a lot of people out there have Anytones. You know, they're not quite as lightweight and kind of flimsy as Baofeng Chinese radios, but then there's a major price difference. Of course, the 878 goes for $200 and change, whereas a Baofeng V5 that doesn't do DMR, I think you could pick one up for $25. But, you know, you could pick each of those, one of those up in each of your hands and have, feel the inordinate weight difference between the two of them. So it feels like a well-designed, well-built machine. The switches, the contacts, the, you know, everything you gotta, the buttons, they don't feel inexpensive, let us say. So enjoy it, Chet, and everyone out there, if you're inclined to go DMRing, either locally or through a hotspot, certainly consider the Anytone radios. They are the dominant radio, as far as I can see, among hotspotters out there.
I would say 90% of the radios I hear on DMR are Anytones.
Yeah, I would agree as well. I mean, it's almost like there's no point in asking people what radio you're using. The answer is usually an 878, occasionally an 868, but it's almost always an Anytone. You know, it's much more significant than if you ask the question on HF. About one-third to one-half of all people answering that question will inevitably tell you that they're using an ICOM 7300.
And a NFED antenna that's replacing the dipole.
2BZ.
Okay, Chet. NFEDs are one of the simplest to put up and deal with. I hope you have lots of contacts. We're coming up. The sunspot cycle eventually is going to be upon us. Maximum 10 meters was really rotten today. I talked to New Jersey. That was my TX station. But I wish you luck on your NFED. Rich, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was talking today to a guy who has a 7300 who said from his radio shack the noise floor is about a 4 and can get up as high as a 5 in a park. He lives near a park. When he goes there and feeds it with, I forgot what battery, it's either 1 or a 0. So that must be quite disheartening.
Well, unfortunately, that's urban environment. We're all packed together. If he was living in a country house that you know, separated from his neighbor by 2 acres, that wouldn't be a problem. I mean, I get the same kind of noise floor. My noise floor is somewhere between S3 and S4 on most of the bands. That's just what it is. There's a lot of people with a lot of wall warts and fluorescent ballasts and all kinds of nasty, noisy stuff around. So, you know, I mean, that's what you have to pay for to live amongst the civilization. If you want to live in the forest, you can probably have a much quieter background.
Yeah, but it's those bears that get you.
Yeah, but the bears aren't going to give you any kind of RFI. So, you know, except for being eaten or having your food stolen, picnic baskets, what have you, it certainly won't impact upon your DXing.
No argument there. No argument there. Imagine somebody sitting in a tent with a shotgun and a 7300 trying to work all states or something like that. Funny image. Anyway, 73, back to net.
Okay, I mean, I have listened to some of our brethren on 75 and 40 meters, and it would not surprise me at all that when they do mobile in a tent or something, that they're not carrying something particularly powerful. You know, there's a lot of guys out there with shotguns and amateur radio equipment, so the two probably go together nicely. And it doesn't produce any RFI either.
One more time, sorry, WB2HX.
Don't be sorry, Chet. It's always a good thing talking with you. What would you like to say, Chet?
I'd like to say that I don't have an inset antenna. I have in my case, 40 meters, I have a folded dipole, but what I'm saying is when I work people on HF a lot, minimum of 50% of the people, it seems, are using the 7300s, and then they have an NFED antenna. In other words, that's the combination, that's the combo of today. Years ago, it used to be a multitude of different rigs, and maybe the first antenna a new guy would use would be a dipole. But now, let's listen very carefully, guys, and most of them are using NFED antennas. They work very well. I don't have any excursions to that type of antenna. I'm even going to build one for 75 soon. I got some materials in. So I'll build one for 75 someday, maybe in the next month or so. Hopefully I can get it on my property. I don't have much room here. But that's the new ubiquitous radio, a 7300 and the NFED antenna.
Okay, very good. I'm sorry I misunderstood. Well, you know, radios go through, every kind of decade it seems that there's one radio that meets a price point, quality, and specs, and every other guy has it. 10 years ago, when I first got into this hobby, the generic answer tended to be the Kenwood TS-2000. John, who used to do the mailbag here on the TechNet, had, I think, four or five. He really liked the TS-2000. Wesley has a TS-2000. A lot of people had TS-2000. And I think around that time, G5RVs seemed to be the antenna to get. I was hearing a lot of people suggesting G5RVs at the very beginning of my hobby days. It's kind of paled and faded away. It's good. It's not good for everyone. Some people love it. Some people hate it. It's a multimodal type of odd design that's very difficult to explain how it actually works. And it's very sensitive to its environment. I like dipoles. I find them very simple. They do require three connection points, where the NFED only requires two. You got to worry a little bit about getting RF into your shack, though, but as long as you have a good ground and a good choke system, that shouldn't be a problem. So, I would agree with you. NFED is incredibly popular these days. Well, once again, I am AC2GS, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. My name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and this is the Limark technical mess. So if anyone out there has come up with any technical questions or topics they would like to discuss, please give me your call sign and your first name.
Well, Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
Are all NFEDs terminated with either a 9 to 1 or a 49 to 1?
Most at work are. The point being that it really depends upon whether you are using them as a half-wave NSAID or a non-resonant NSAID. If you're using them as a half-wave, you have a rather high impedance. The impedance of a dipole, a half-wave dipole with a monopole on one side and a quarter-wave monopole on the other side, the center feed is the lowest impedance for that antenna at approximately 50 ohms. As you slide the center feed off-center, the impedance grows higher and higher, and at the very edge, it approaches anywhere from 2 to 3,000 ohms. So in order to get it anywhere near an antenna tuner is going to be able to do something with, you need something like a 49 to 1 balance. If, on the other hand, it is a non-resonant NSAID where the impedances go all over the damn place, a lot of times people will just use a far simpler 9 to 1 and finish it up with an antenna a tuner.
I've wound both of those, and it doesn't seem that much harder to wind a 49 to 1 as opposed to, you know, a 9 to 1. So wouldn't somebody, if you had the choice, go with a 49 to 1 every time? Or is there something in the design of the antenna that I'm missing? Go ahead.
I think the bottom line is what the impedance is doing as you sweep it across the bands that you're interested in. If there are points where your sweep is going to end up with an impedance, you know, in the 2,000 range, yes, you would be better off with a 49 to 1. If not, then you're probably better off with a lower transformer ratio of something like 9 to 1. You know, you know, 6 to 1, half a dozen of the other. I mean, a very good antenna tuner can probably tune a something that's now at a very low impedance because it ran through a 49 to 1 transformer balance. But usually, in the practice that I've seen happen, if you're going for just a non-resonant NSAID, most times people will do a 9 to 1. There's not much of a benefit with that situation of going all the way up to a 49 to 1.
And why is it preferable electronically to use a 9 to 1 if you can get away with it?
I'm not quite sure what that question is. You want to rephrase it?
You said it's preferable to use a 9 to 1 if you could get away with it and not use a 49 to 1. So the question was, why is it more favorable to use a 9 to 1 than a 49 to 1 other than the chore of winding the core?
Well, it's also a matter of dealing with the final impedance numbers that you're getting. You would like them to be as close to 50 as possible. If you are not going to be operating the NSAID as a half wave, you're not going to get impedances quite as high as 2 or 3,000. So when you wreck them with a rather large ratio of a 49 to 1, you're then going to have to deal with a very, very low nominal impedance through the antenna tuner. So, you know, the less you adjust through the antenna tuner, the better, because you end up with that transmission line problem of attenuation. You know, you don't want an impedance mismatch when it gets off of the balance, or as little of a mismatch as you can when it gets past the balance into the transmission line and then onto the antenna tuner.
So don't you have a better match coming off a 49 to 1 than you do a 9 to 1?
Again, you would if you were operating as a true half-wave NSAID. But if it is not a half-wave NSAID, then the nominal impedance will be significantly lower than that 2 or 3,000 that's seen when you're using it as a resonant half-wave NSAID. And so, although that's very useful for those numbers, if your antenna is now showing an impedance of, say, 600 ohms, and you smack it with a 49-to-1, that's a little bit too much of a good thing. So now you gotta correct for that problem. So again, it's probably better not to be as aggressive as long as you know that you're not going to be using your NSAID really as a true half-wave resonance one.
Okay, so I guess you need to know the length of the antenna and when it's best to use the 9-to-1, and when that crosses over to it's best to use the 49-to-1.
Well, yeah, but usually companies will sell and designs will discuss both two different types of NSAIDs, the half-wave NSAID and the random or non-resident NSAID. So you would both need to know the bands you're using for this NSAID and the length of the NSAID. And if the length correlates with the half-wave length of the band that you're interested in, then effectively you're putting up a half-wave NSAID antenna, and you should have a 49-to-1. If, on the other hand, most, if not all of the time, you'll be nowhere near a half-wave length distance in the NSAID, then you're probably better off to go with a 9-to-1.
Understood. Got it now, Roy. Thanks.
You're welcome, Rich. Thanks for participating. Once again, I am Phil, AC2GS. This is Phil, the Limar Technical Net. And I'll ask again, if anyone has any technical amateur radio-related questions, please hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and your call sign.
K2GJE, Ed.
Yes, Ed. What can I do for you tonight?
Evening. I tried to do some research online of the FCC Part 95, and it just goes for pages now. I was very curious about remote control. Originally, they said no remote control of amateur equipment, and then repeaters came along, and they modified the law for the repeaters, because there's no operator sitting usually at the repeater equipment site. What about us amateurs with not...
You dropped out at the very end of that sentence. Ed, you cut out at near the end of the sentence. You want to repeat the last sentence, please?
I wanted to know what's the law in Part 95 for a person not running a repeater, just running their own station, remote controlling it. Over.
Okay. As I often state, I am not a lawyer and I don't even play one on the radio. But remote control of radios is incredibly common these days. There are some requirements, as always. Even radios you're using locally, you have to identify every 10 minutes. You have to be able to have a kill switch controlling the radio so that it can't just kind of go into some kind of feedback forever and ever. But aside from simple things like that, people all over the place. My Flex 6700 is very easily capable of remote accessing and remote use. MFJ sells an interesting device. I think it's called a 1234, which is a remote control system for radios that is getting a lot of use. A lot of radios are set up for remote use. There is software from third parties. There's software from manufacturers. There is a company that's dedicated to renting out their massive, contest-worthy shack that you can remote into it using different methods and operate it from afar. So it's open season, to the point where there have been a lot of angry discussions of contesting. A lot of people don't consider it to be a nice thing to be able to sit in New York, operate remotely a radio in California, and then talk to Hawaii, whatever. That's, you know, to them, that's not fair. You should base it on the location of the radio, not the operator. But as far as I know, the FCC has kind of opened the door. As long as you maintain rather standard rules for remote-controlled radios, you too can operate a remote-controlled radio.
Okay, I'll buy that. I could not find anything really clear, black and white, in Part 95 FCC on the Internet. They speak about a lot of laws referring to commercial radio systems. I guess that's why we have a timeout on our repeater. Over.
Well, the rationale I understand for the timeout is simply to sync all of the secondary relay systems that we maintain. Not only do we have a relay between W2VL and our Plainview repeater, but we also have the IRLP link, and we also have the Echo link. And so when it was asked, why the timeout, the answer invariably was to sync up all of those gateway devices. It was shorter years ago. The new technical staff has figured out ways to make it give us a little bit longer breathing time, so that's good. But ultimately, if we didn't have these timeouts, things would go wonky with EchoLink and IRLP.
Do you have time out for some more questions?
Certainly.
Well, one reason I brought up this subject years ago, not just last year, a gentleman was fined for not being at his station. The station was on the air, and he was not there. So evidently the law has changed considerably. I believe they also removed his equipment because he was also operating a considerable amount of power. Over.
Well, yeah, I mean, ultimately, laws are changeable depending upon technology. The technology for remote controlling a radio has escalated in the last 20 years spectacularly. You can image the a pan adapter. You can get a graphic display of more on a computer screen 1,000 miles away than you could from an old radio looking staring at the front of it. So the FCC kind of thankfully can change its mind. In the old days, you really had to put together something dubious to remotely control it, and probably the off switch, the kill switch, was the second thought for most of these guys. So nowadays, with the incredible demand and the incredible capability, like I said, it's not unusual to, or it's not quite like the 7300 and the NFED antenna, but there's a lot more people out there operating remotely. When I first got my license 10 years ago, I did not have a radio to save my life. I didn't have a handy talkie. I didn't have anything. What I had was a license. With the license, I got access to EchoLink. Using EchoLink, there were very kind amateur radio operators, mostly for some reason in the Midwest, who tied their radios to a software on a Windows product that got controlled through EchoLink. And I was able to actually use their radios remotely by triggering it using commands on EchoLink. And that's 10 years ago. And it's only gotten much, much more powerful these days.
Okay, very interesting. Can we go back and talk a little bit also about parallel resonant circuit traps? Over.
Sure, Ed.
GJE for ID. Parallel resonant trap is nothing more than a capacitor and an inductor in parallel. It is resonant when X of L equals X of C at a particular frequency, and all of this you can very easily calculate. I've done it many times for parallel resonance circuits for things that I've built. That's no problem. What I don't know how to do, how do you calculate the impedance of that circuit? Because using it as a trap, you want it to be at least, I guess, 5 or 10 times more than the feed line impedance. I mean, we see this happen, for instance, in a parallel resonance circuit. When you tune it, you get the smallest amount of current because it's at the highest impedance. But how do you calculate that impedance over?
Yes, Wesley, you wanted to make a comment.
Okay. So, inversion of resonant circuit is, it is open, I'm sorry. It is open for this given frequency. So let's say you have a series resonant circuit and then 18 resonance. They are a little bit lower than that is capacitive, a little bit higher than that is inductive, but it's zero. It's just letting blocked, but all of the other frequencies are open. What is the question about the impedance? We have either open, either closed. We get out of the bandwidth of the filter, because a resonant circuit is the filter. Then we have either open, either closed. It's like logic 1 or 0. That's part of the answer I have somewhere.
Okay, Wes. Ed wants to know how you would calculate when the trap is operating at its highest impedance, because you would want to design something that's resonant, but you would also want to design something that's at least 5 times the impedance of the feed point. That's his question. Now, I would assume it's kind of the simple equation, half simple. You know, 1 over ZL plus 1 over ZC. You know, I would assume that would give you the parallel impedance, right?
Was this question to me?
Well, no, I was really asking Ed, but you can comment after Ed.
These are not perfect components. Neither is the capacitor perfect, nor is the inductor perfect. And if we made a vector diagram, they would not be 180 degrees apart, but they would be close, and they would give you then some vector of a high impedance. Okay, what is that impedance when that circuit is at resonance? Over.
WB2EAZ.
Okay, Ed, come in and tell us the answer.
Alright, for a series resonance circuit, you take the positive impedance of the inductor and the negative impedance of the capacitor, and at resonance, the equal and opposite sum up to zero, so you have a short circuit. Parallel is 1 over that, the impedance of the inductor plus the impedance of the capacitor, so when at resonance, it's 1 over 0 or infinite, i.e. open circuit. Whether or not these are perfect really just tweaks it. It just changes the resonant frequency or the impedances a little bit. Let me drop a second.
Ed, can I ask you something?
Go ahead.
Wouldn't it be 1 over the impedance of the inductor plus 1 over the impedance of the capacitor? In other words, rather than 1 over the impedance plus the impedance, the reactive inductance and capacitive inductance, capacitive reactant, rather. Isn't it 1 over that for the equation of the impedance of a parallel circuit in resonance?
Let me put it this way. I'm winging this right now, so I could be wrong, but here's my point. Those impedances subtract. One, inductance is positive, capacitance is negative. Remember, it's 90 degrees out from any resistance. The idea is when the impedances are equal at the frequency where the inductive and capacitive impedances are equal in a parallel circuit, it's 1 over, say, plus 5, minus 5, or 1 over 0, which is infinite. It's possible I'm wrong with a narrow sense, but the idea being is when the impedances are equal, you have to get an infinite impedance of the network.
Okay, I'm unsure of that, shall I say. I will have to go back into the books and figure that out. My understanding is that there is actually a problem. And when you actually design parallel resonant traps, you have to design them in such a way and pick the proper capacitive and inductance such that the resonant impedance is 5 times the feed point. If the trap is inherently infinite at resonance, then I don't think anyone would tell people to be careful about that part.
I am not getting into the design of the antenna, just of a parallel LC network. You may very well be right, and I am making no attempt to address it as a subject of trap antenna design.
CDH for the comment.
Yes, Mr. John.
I think it's going to depend on the Q of the coil. A Q can be viewed as inductive reactance in series with some resistance, which exhibits the loss of the coil. So when you put that all into the parallel resonant equation, at resonance, rather than getting a pure open circuit, you are left with some high impedance, again, due to the Q, the quality factor of the coil. Most of the time, I think the capacitor, you can view it, or although the capacitance can exhibit some loss too, but most of it, I think, comes from the coil. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm just, you know, I mean, the Q is a factor. It certainly is a factor in the characteristic slope, the specificity, what have you, of the resonance. But, you know, does this sound at all like an actual equation? I mean, I just keep on thinking in terms of, you know, 1 over the sum of 1 over the inductive reactant plus 1 over the capacitive reactant. I think that's an equation for parallel impedance, though.
Well, yeah, I would see it as pretty much product over the sum. J omega L times 1 over J omega C divided by J omega L plus 1 over J omega C. That's if it was pure inductor, pure capacitor. Now, with the coil having some Q, it's omega L plus some R series with the inductor. So when you run that all into there, then the effect is that at resonance, you don't see an open circuit. You see some high resistance. Due to the fact that the coil has some losses.
And why, Tony?
Yes, Tony.
I am totally unqualified to speak to formulas. Reference the last page of the DNA steel coil I built today. You'll see a correlation between the overall sweep and the T sweep. See the point reference that if you look at point 2 on one side, which is the point of residence, and point 2 on the chart. Those 1.74 kilohms for the points of resonance on that particular track. So it's not infinite, it's some finite number.
Okay, so I guess the problem is that we all have non-theoretical real components. They do not have perfect reactants, inductive and capacitive, and that kind of muddies the water. So my other question to the people out there pondering this is this something that you can plug into an equation and come up with? Now, it was suggested that maybe the Q is the basic fundamental way of guessing what that final resonant impedance is. Or do you physically have to plug in real components and sweep them as Tony just demonstrated?
WB2EAV?
Yes, Ed.
I think we're missing the forest for the trees here. The question was meant to be rather general, and you're going down the rabbit hole of more and more details that will give you maybe a 10% change in performance, and you'll end up in the loony bin getting there. My philosophy is let's keep it simple, and then we add complexity, not the other way around.
Okay, fine, Ed, but I mean, the question is, basically, as I gleaned from Ed, is what is the easiest, quickest method of coming up with a acceptable resonant set of values for the capacitor and the inductor, where the ultimate impedance will be good for the purpose of building a trap?
That's not the way I heard the question asked. What I heard was, if you're off resonance, how do you estimate the impedance?
Oh, okay. Maybe I misunderstood. Ed, do you want to clarify?
The frequency that the trap was designed for, not off resonance either way. Over.
Okay, so that's what I thought, Ed.